This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. This week, we're connecting the dots between a prophecy from 1918, a metaphorical bloodbath, and electric vehicles. I know. How are all of these things related? Well, we're going to find out with NPR's transportation correspondent, Camila Domonoski, and Dan Brecky, a reporter and editor at KQED in San Francisco who covers transit. Camila, Dan, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
So happy to be here.
Oh, it's great to be here.
All right. We are getting in gear. So y'all may have heard, but we are in the middle of an election year, which means that literally anything could become the next hot issue. And one of the things I have been surprised to see become a political issue this year is electric vehicles. President Biden has been pushing new regulations to promote EV production to combat the climate crisis.
Yeah, transportation is the single largest source of emissions in the United States.
That's right.
Of carbon emissions, yeah.
And former President Trump is using those regulations as a talking point against Biden. And people are responding.
We're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line. And you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected. Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
Cars are essential to American life. They're this invisible cultural force that we all have an emotional attachment to, maybe even an anxious attachment. And today I want to get into why Americans are so invested in their cars and why cars aren't just a policy battle, but part of the culture wars. To start off, Camila, Dan, what do you think is the relationship between Americans and their cars? How would you describe that relationship?
Obsessed.
Obsessed.
Americans, we buy a lot of cars. We drive those cars many, many miles, sort of compared to the rest of the world. Cars are so central to people's identities and on a very practical level to life in America. They play a huge role.
Well, you know, I am a little mad because my word was obsessive, which is pretty much what Camila said. But what I reflect on is what a rite of passage it is for so many Americans to get their first driver's license, to have what is perceived as the freedom of driving, of getting in your car and going wherever you want. And that is a part of the American mythos and ethos.
How about you, Brittany?
I would agree. I think that we are dependent on our cars, and I think that our cars make us dependent on each other in a lot of ways. Camila, when we were preparing for this conversation, you talked about how cars are our access point for healthcare and income. Mm-hmm. We sometimes need them to get urgent medical attention or to get to our jobs. But I also think about how they organize our familial relationships. And like living in New York City, where I have all of this public transportation, the kids are more independent at a younger age. Most young people are dependent on their parents to get around. Our cars can be our access to freedom, especially as we come of age, but they're also a sign of how dependent we are on them. Which brings me to my next point. Like, if cars are both a symbol of freedom and dependence, is it surprising to either of you that cars are becoming a political issue in the 2024 presidential election?
No, I don't think it's surprising. I mean, they are both economically significant to this country, and they have this emotional resonance. And the transition that the auto industry is going through, the switch to electric vehicles, battery-powered vehicles, is tied to the climate crisis, which is a political flashpoint. So in a way, I think it would have been almost more surprising if this didn't become politicized in some way.
You know, it is and it isn't. The thing that isn't surprising, and it goes to what Camila was saying, is that for a long time, the automobile industry was viewed as the backbone of America's industrial economy.
Right.
That's a great wedge issue. If, you know, the Biden administration in this case is proposing emission rules that will increase the adoption of electric vehicles, that could be posed by another party, let's say the Republicans and Donald Trump, as a threat, as a deadly threat to the livelihoods of people who are still working in that industry. The part that is surprising is that electric vehicles are technology. And in California, this is just an accepted part, not only of the future, of the present. I mean, electric car sales in California are huge. 25% of all new car registrations last year here in California were electric.
That's a huge number.
It is huge. It's much bigger than anywhere else in the country, and it's only getting bigger over time. Buyers really want the cars for a variety of reasons. They perform well, and they are, to some extent, a status symbol. And people are really adopting them out of the thought that they're doing something good for the environment.
Right.
You know, Dan is in California, where there is a ban on gas-powered cars, or exclusively gas-powered cars, that is in place. And not immediate, but by 2035, you won't be able to sell a purely gas-powered car in California.
Well, you will be able to sell a used car.
A used one.
That's yeah. You won't be able to sell a new one.
Important clarification, yeah. Right. In the rest of the country, there are states that have adopted California's rules or are considering adopting them. And it was really interesting to me, in the most recent round of elections, states like Virginia and New Jersey, Republicans really pushed on these plans as bans of gas cars, which are unpopular. But we are absolutely going to see this continue to be a political issue, because a ban on a currently very popular product is not something that's going to appeal to most people, right? So there are state-level either mandates, electric vehicle mandates and requirements in place, or proposals. On a federal level, that's not the case. The Biden administration has policies that are designed to encourage, promote, require automakers to make more electric vehicles, but not 100% electric vehicles.
Not exclusively.
There's no federal plan to ban gas-powered cars right now, but the oil industry in particular has seized on this idea of a ban and has expanded it. The oil industry is spending millions of dollars on ads in swing states talking about Biden's car ban. And what it is it's taking these state-level policies and conflating them with the federal policies to frame any effort to promote electric vehicles as an attack on choice, an attack on freedom, which goes back to what cars symbolize to the American people, right?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, you know, the points that you each have brought up, I mean, they remind me of the kind of comments that Trump has been making. You know, a few weeks ago, former President Trump made some headlines when he used the word bloodbath when he was talking about electric vehicle manufacturing. He said that electric vehicles would, quote unquote, kill the American automobile industry. He said it would be a, quote, assassination of jobs. That's really strong language. As people who watch automobile consumption, why does that kind of reaction, that sort of language in response to electric vehicle manufacturing, resonate with the public?
I think it really plays on people's fears and resentments. And look, that's very finely calculated language. It may sound like off-the-cuff bombast. It's not. Michigan is a state that Trump has to have to win the presidency again.
Right, because Michigan has a long history of car production.
I think it's as simple as that.
It also is so striking to me how if you are going to think about this moment for the auto industry as a fight for your life, the auto industry sees it in the other direction. The auto industry sees this as investing in being able to build cutting-edge technology is what they need to do to win the fight, martial terms, with China over the future of the auto market. So there's this tremendous disconnect between this language that Trump is using allegedly on behalf of the auto industry, but with a massive disconnect to the way that they talk about their stakes for the future.
You know, there is another part of this where electric vehicles themselves are being described as evil in some way or as an enemy of the people. That seems irrational to me in the same way that a lot of the language we've heard about the COVID-19 vaccines, for instance, that they were just bad, that they were part of a government conspiracy to change the way we live and the way we enjoy our freedoms.
You know, it's funny. We keep circling back to anxieties about the future. And I kind of want to throw this out to you all. Like, how much of all of the hand-wringing, the tossing around of the terms assassination and bloodbath, or even worry or anxiety from consumers, like how much of this is a cultural opposition to the vehicles themselves? And how much of it is just an inability to picture the future, or picture a different future? I mean, you know, you're also asking people to rethink how they're going to fuel their car, asking people to imagine a future where they have to like plan ahead and possibly charge their car electrically for 2, 6, 8 hours. I mean, it's a pretty big cultural shift.
There's also the reality that right now there are some situations where it's very difficult. If you're in an apartment building where you don't have dedicated parking at all, let alone parking next to a charger, currently there are lots of plans for how to have street-side charging. There's a company called It's Electric, Brittany, who has a plan in New York City for having these chargers along the streetscape that would sort of look...
We don't have any more space.
They would No, they would look like a fire hydrant.
I mean, I see the vision. Like, we don't have any more space.
So it would sort of be like somewhere between a fire hydrant and a bike lock, right? Like those curved things that a bike locks in. And so if you're parking on the street anyway, you plug into the charger that's like right on the edge of the sidewalk. But these are things that don't exist yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were asking about a cultural shift, Brittany, and sort of the cultural implications of this. You know, California always fancies itself to be out there on the bleeding edge of what's going to happen everywhere else in America. In terms of electric vehicle adoption, it does happen to be true. And I'm talking to you from the future. And I can tell you that it's safe here. You can have electric vehicles and they'll perform well. You'll still have traffic jams like you have with gas-powered cars. You'll still have drivers doing really bad things on the road in their electric vehicles. It'll be a very familiar place. You don't see any big social dislocation here from the adoption of electric vehicles.
To close out, what do you think it says about our culture right now that cars have become such a political issue?
You know, I think cars have always been a political issue. One of my favorite movies is an Orson Welles movie from 1941, I think, The Magnificent Ambersons.
You really think they're going to change the face of the land?
They're already doing it, Major, and it can't be stopped.
Automobiles are a useless nuisance.
And there's a wonderful speech offered by Joseph Cotten, the actor, about what automobiles may do to the United States.
Almost all outward things are going to be different because of what they bring. They're going to alter war and they're going to alter peace. And I think men's minds are going to be changed in subtle ways because of automobiles.
So what you're saying is that Americans have always been anxious about how cars are going to shape the future.
A political debate about cars and their place in the economic landscape and personal landscape is just back to the future, which actually featured a DeLorean.
Well, Camila, Dan, we will see how all of this turns out, but it is clear that cars are on everybody's minds right now. It was so great to talk to both of you about this. Thank you so much.
Hooray!
Well, you're welcome, and it's been delightful to talk to the two of you.
Thanks for having us.
That was NPR's Camila Domonoske and KQED's Dan Brecky. We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we're getting into the child star industry and just what it's like to be an adolescent in Hollywood. We'll be right back.
The following message comes from NPR sponsor Sattva. Founder and CEO Ron Rudson is proud that each Sattva mattress is made to order.
Your mattress has a birth date after you order it. Nothing sits in muggy warehouses. Nothing sits in muggy basements of stores. When you order it, you're getting your product made fresh for you, and people love that.
To learn more, go to SAATVA.com/NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu. This message comes from NPR sponsor Discover. Here's a familiar situation. You have a question about your credit card. You call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone. If only you had a Discover card. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
A warning to listeners, this segment contains mention of violence, sexual harassment, and child sexual abuse. A new documentary series called Quiet On Set is rocking the culture right now because it focuses on something a lot of us hold nostalgia for, Nickelodeon, the children's TV network. Nickelodeon! This documentary has some truly horrifying allegations. It claims patterns of sexual harassment happening behind the scenes of some of the most popular kids' shows of the 90s and 2000s, some of which I grew up watching. The doc centers on a producer named Dan Schneider. He wrote for, show ran, produced, and created some of the network's biggest shows, like All That, The Amanda Show, Drake and Josh, and iCarly. The documentary alleges that Schneider put young actors in sexually suggestive scenes and harassed women writers. But the biggest bombshell of the doc is that it names three pedophiles that worked under him. They were all convicted for sexual abuse or committing lewd acts with minors. In the documentary, Drake Bell of Drake and Josh comes forward as one of the victims of Nickelodeon dialogue coach Brian Peck. But Drake is only one of many child stars that have described experiences that range from feeling uncomfortable taking part in sexualized gags to facing downright sexual abuse while working for Nickelodeon. But my guests today say that this problem is bigger than Dan Schneider and Nickelodeon.
In Hollywood, actor comes before child. We don't see these kids as real children.
That's Joan Summers, co-host of the Eating for Free podcast, which she hosts with Matthew Lawson. The two of them have a series called Child Star Hell, which is exactly what it sounds like. They've looked into how child stardom has shaped celebrities like Ariana Grande and Justin Bieber, and how it set them up for exploitation from the very beginning. I sat down with Joan and Matt to discuss Quiet On Set and what it is about child stars that make them uniquely vulnerable to abuse. Joan, Matt, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Thank you for having us. This is one of my favorite podcasts. I'm so excited to be here and talk to you.
I know. What a privilege, honestly.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, so you've covered the exploitation of some really big child stars on your show, but abuse and mistreatment of children in Hollywood has been going on for at least a century. Like,
yes,
many people have said that Judy Garland was given Speed by MGM, but
yeah,
there's always this initial shock when we hear about a new instance of child abuse in the entertainment industry. Why is it so hard for some people to see these kids as victims right away?
I think something that we really have to reckon with as a society is that people do not see actors or people who benefit from the Hollywood system as real people. I think we see this all the time with the abuse celebrities face online. And I think in Hollywood, actor comes before child.
Well, you see them as a bunch of little employees.
Yeah, you see them as little future employees and millionaires and beneficiaries of this system. And we see what happens to them as just a consequence of the life that we see they chose. When we know for a fact from countless testimonies, these children are not always participating in this willingly. Whether or not a kid thinks I want to be a famous person, we have seen time and time again these reactions to their lives or their dropping out of the public eye or trying to fight against conservatorships as a reaction to a life that was imposed on them too. So we know that that's not true, that they always are choosing this, but I think still society doesn't see them like real people. I think that's a problem with children generally in our society, which is why child influencers are a thing. And for a long time, we're not questioned. It really makes me sick to think about, truly.
You know, part of the reason we're talking about this now is because of all the hubbub around Quiet on Set,
yes,
which goes deep on Dan Schneider's alleged wrongdoings during his time as a producer and creator at Nickelodeon. And yet you both see this documentary as focusing a little too much on this harmful individual rather than looking at the larger system. Matt, could you say more about that?
Yeah. I felt like the second the documentary ended, almost like a light bulb went off my head and I went, why didn't we learn about anyone who was working above Dan? Like, it always was all about Dan, his control of the strata of who's working on set, the costume designers, the actors, the PAs. That was great. I'm happy to see that. That's very important to the conversation. But who's working with Dan at the top? Who are the board leaders and executives that are working on these projects? They're the ones who greenlight everything. And it's upsetting to even say Dan's response to the directors of this documentary, the last statement at the end, it's the last frame. Dan says, there's a standards and practice board. There are parents who are on set. This is a team project of everyone at Nickelodeon that's related to these programs.
Nickelodeon has released a statement saying, though we cannot corroborate or negate allegations of behaviors from productions decades ago, Nickelodeon, as a matter of policy, investigates all formal complaints as part of our commitment to fostering a safe and professional workplace environment free of harassment or other kinds of inappropriate conduct. Our highest priorities are the well-being and best interests of not just our employees, casts, and crew, but of all children, and we have adopted numerous safeguards over the years to help ensure we are living up to our own high standards and the expectations of our audience. Dan Schneider has responded too. He said, quote, I definitely owe some people a pretty strong apology. He has apologized for asking crew members for massages and for the sexually explicit jokes he asked the women writers to participate in, saying it wouldn't happen today, but I'm just really sorry it happened. As for sexually suggestive scenes that young actors performed in, he said, if anybody had said anything like, hey, we don't like that, that's not appropriate, it would have been cut out. Schneider also said about Drake Bell's account that, quote, when Drake and I talked and he told me what had happened, I was more devastated by that than anything that ever happened in my career thus far. I told him, I'm here for you. What do you need? Okay, back to Joan and Matt, who feel the documentary could have critiqued the powers that be a little bit more.
We say on our podcast a lot that gossip without a critique of power or structure is just gossip, right? And a lot of the Me Too reporting that I experienced, I want to give a shout out to my wonderful editor at Jezebel, Stassa Edwards, who taught me that, like, you don't always deserve the story of somebody who is a victim of something horrific, especially during Me Too, putting a mic in front of an actress's face and being like, in front of the world, recount the worst experience you ever had. That was seen as the strategy, I think, by a lot of people to get people to care about this. And I think that really these stories matter regardless of us knowing the details. We never should have really, I think, known them outside of maybe what Drake felt comfortable sharing. But now that we know them, that was what the documentary was really sold to people as. And there was so much more that I think was left unsaid in service of that salaciousness and that really like exploitative peek into what was going on behind the scenes. Like, Hollywood is a system with protections in place for child stars, and those protections failed. Right. At literally every level. Hollywood has mandates for the amount of time they spend in school, how many hours they're supposed to work, how much money is supposed to go into accounts for them based on the money that they make. And we know that these systems fail all of the time. And you see in this Quiet on Set documentary that failure at every level. And when we entrust children to a system that is fundamentally broken and it continues to break time and time again and show how flawed it is, and it does not change, that to me feels like the story here, right? It is much bigger than a single incident of abuse or a pattern of abuse from one boss.
You've brought up Me Too a couple times in this conversation. How do you see the systems of child abuse we see in the entertainment industry as related to the behaviors that were exposed in the Me Too movement?
If you look at what Dan Schneider was putting his female employees in on screen that were underage, That mirrors the way he treated his adult employees in private.
Exactly.
Humiliating women, I think, is sort of core to what it seems he was all about. Mm. And if he is humiliating adult women who are professionals, who are working, who are making his TV show successful, imagine how he must feel about the girls. There isn't an age at which people say, okay, I'm going to abuse you now. That abuse starts at all levels.
Coming up, what makes child stars especially vulnerable to abuse? Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the acclaimed true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy. Support for NPR and the following message come from the American Cancer Society. Dr. Alpa Patel leads a team that researches cancer risk factors, and she shares how her team makes an impact.
We always do what we like to think of as actionable science. So the work that we do makes its way to things like nutrition and physical activity guidelines for cancer.org, where millions of people come each year to learn about how they can better prevent cancer.
To learn more, go to cancer.org. This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing, backpacking, and another outdoor thing that rhymes with backpacking. Visit your local REI co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways you can opt outside.
I want to get into some more of the systemic issues that you brought up. I mean, working in Hollywood can be damaging for even the most mature, privileged, and level-headed adult. What about the entertainment industry puts children in a uniquely vulnerable position?
These kids are in a completely isolated environment. They're not socialized like most kids are, where they're among people their age. They don't really go home even to their parents sometimes. We saw with Drake Bell, he was living with his abuser. He was living with somebody who was exploiting him almost all hours of the day. Yeah. And their only measure of output is how talented they are and how well they work with everybody. Any little, you know, resistance or friction that they generate or the parents generate, as we saw in that documentary as well, they can be out in a second. And honestly, the more we've looked into it, the more I can't stop comparing it to a cult-like behavior. You know, you're kept isolated, you're in control 24/7. Sometimes these kids are working when they're babies. I mean, they're quite literally being used in commercials and in scenes months after they're born. And that's all they know.
You know, I was talking to Matt the other day. I had a job when I was 15 that worked me too many hours. It was like illegal how many hours I was working. They paid me under the table. Mm. I liked making the money at that age, right? I needed that money to have things like a phone and pay for my car and stuff. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it was easy for them to do that in just like a rural town in California. But if that job was also in charge of my school, if that job was also my parent, it would have been so much worse. You know, we don't allow that to happen to 12-year-olds just out in society. It does happen regardless, but it is looked down upon if a kid who's like 12 is clearly in an exploitative position and you're like, why is this 11-year-old my cashier at this store? But it's not weird in Hollywood. And then the level of they're in charge of everything in your life. I mean, I want to bring Justin Bieber into this for a second. When Justin Bieber was scouted by Scooter Braun, his mom was a single mom living on government subsidies. She was a young mom and she was struggling financially. This is all very public information. Right. Scooter moved them to Atlanta, to a country they were not citizens of. And so we know what trouble immigrants have in America finding work regardless. Even if you are a white Canadian working under Scooter Braun, I can't imagine it was easy to just like go and find a gas station job. Think about what level of exploitation that can set a child up for if that is the position that they are put in.
I keep thinking about the stereotype of the troubled child star, the troubled former child star, you know, who can't get it together when they're all grown up. Often this might look like hard drugs, partying, public breakdowns, dramatic changes in appearance that seem to signal a desire to break away from what may have been a previously very polished or conventionally pretty image. I see all of this as a very potent image that also potentially provides cover for the systems that ultimately fail these children. Does that resonate with you guys?
Child stars leaving that industry completely messed up is the norm. Like, it's not rare. That is not considered an aberration in the system. When Miley Cyrus, quote unquote, turned, it was seen as like the next step in her career as a former Disney star.
Right. Her Robin Thicke era, where she was like twerking on stage and definitely not a Disney princess anymore.
It was not seen as like, what is really going on?
Is she okay? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that I couldn't stop thinking about after watching the documentary was your goal is to get kids glued and addicted to these televisions. And one of the ways they do that is, of course, you got to have kids that are relatable, that we enjoy, we think are aspirational. With that being said, none of these children are those archetypes. They're not real. It's not possible to be the perfect teenager. I think we all know that teenagers are inherently some of the worst and most annoying people that you can be around.
I was at the time.
It's just what the experiences is. We were all terrible. And yet Disney and Nickelodeon have to be like, no, these are fantastic, aspirational, successful, perfect children. So inherently they're set up to fail. Mm. And I think when these kids, and most of Hollywood we know, have access to a lot of money, drugs, and very toxic and dangerous lifestyles, it's too easy for them to fall into it. And it's something that most teenagers fall into at one point in their life or another.
Without fame or money.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's really, really easy for every little bad thing they do to get into the press and become sensationalized because, like you said, people are kind of obsessed with that troubled child star archetype.
Child stars have been around since the beginning of the entertainment industry, but there have been some really interesting shifts lately in how you become a child star. Like, I'm thinking about the difference between having an agent, going to auditions, versus being plucked off the internet. I wonder, how does internet fame leave children particularly vulnerable compared to more traditional pathways?
One of the earlier episodes we did in our podcast around 2019, we got a kind of anonymous letter to our podcast about working behind the scenes at VidCon and around a lot of these literal like 8-7-year-olds who have millions, tens of million views on their videos. And all this insider saw when they sent this message was these kids are being worked to the bone 18 hours a day. And I'm seeing this in a professional setting. I can only imagine when they're at home with no regulation, no oversight. There's really nothing attached to them. It's just in the home with their family, how much worse this probably is. There is not even really a whispered network among these children working on YouTube or working on TikTok. It's too easy for parents to exploit their children, work them to the bone for content and make all the money because there's no union work. There's no labor laws they have to follow. This is all in the privacy of a home. It's just inherently kind of set up to be more exploitative.
So much of American society and our beliefs about the nuclear family are predicated around the idea that like what happens behind closed doors is none of your business. You know, like don't tell me what to do with my kids.
Don't tell me how to raise my child.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so when we see children in obviously exploitable situations, you see these fan bases around these people or commentators say like, well, it's no one's place to tell this parent what to do with their kid, even if what they're doing with their kid is putting them in front of a Twitch stream for hours a day.
Obviously, there's all of these structural issues that make it possible and extremely likely, I think, for abuse to happen to children in Hollywood. But I wonder, what about the industry also makes it harder for child stars who've experienced this abuse to come forward?
More often than not, there are only downsides to coming forward. I think that it can be a moment of healing for people, but I have listened to so many victims' testimonies where they think that, like, this is going to be a moment of catharsis or healing from them and the weight might lift, but then the abuse continues online or from the industry blacklisting you because you went after a producer that is known to make a lot of money. And when this is the only life you've ever had and you were at a vulnerable, tender age when this horrible thing happened to you, I can imagine for a lot of people, it would probably feel devastating to know that at the end of your career, the thing that is going to be most known about you is the absolute worst thing that could ever happen to a person, let alone a child. And I think a lot of people just aren't ready or don't want to carry that with them.
Despite all we know about all of the terrible things that can happen to children with stardom and being in the entertainment industry or Hollywood or just being famous in general, there's still a demand for people to see child performers. I wonder, what is it about us that demands performances from kids?
I am in a rewatch of Degrassi, Next Generation, famously a show where they have kids playing the age they actually are. It is magic. It is addictive. It is quite literally like something that you never can get anywhere else.
I was their age when they were making it. I was in it. I was watching it all the time.
Yeah, it's very real. It's very real. I mean, they have zits when they're, you know, performing. The makeup artists actually didn't let them cover up their zits because they wanted it to be more real. And we love it. It's so good rewatching it now. I'm definitely going to have to look into some of the production now. I've been avoiding it. But there is like the je ne sais quoi, you could say, about having child actors play their own age and actually play out things that are happening. Unlike shows like Riverdale or Euphoria, it's a very different thing. And I personally don't know how to reckon with that because I don't know still if it's ethical for children to be doing that. I don't know. We've been saying for a while now, we need more regulation, more ways to ensure that kids are not being taken advantage of. Maybe there is a world where we can do all that and still have this content. But I'm not sure. I'm really not sure yet. When we saw Drake at the end of Quiet on Set say, you know, despite all these horrible, horrible, traumatic things that have happened to me, things that are unspeakable, he still feels like it's hard for him to trade that away because of how many good things he got out of the experience and how, you know, a lot of people when they grow up, that's all they want to be is an actor. They want to be famous. And I don't know if there's a way to resolve it yet, and at least the kind of society that we've built ourselves today.
Joan, Matt, thank you so much for joining me today. This was so amazing.
Yeah, been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Joan Summers and Matt Lawson, co-hosts of Eating for Free. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany. It's Jay from California. I saw that former President Donald Trump is now selling $60 Bibles, and I was curious to know what you thought about all this.
Hey, Jay. Thank you so much for calling in with this question. For those of you who don't know, former president and current Republican frontrunner for the presidential election in 2024, Donald Trump, he has gotten into the Bible business. He is selling these Bibles called the God Bless the USA Bible. I don't know about all the other claims of having business sense that he has made over the years. I am not the person to look into the veracity of so many different claims. However, he might have struck gold with the God Bless the USA Bible. I'm going to tell you why. Think about it like this. For lots of reasons, he may need some money. He's got a presidential campaign going. He has various lawsuits that need tending to. He's got fees that he owes certain people that he also needs to make sure that he is current on. And what better way to make money than by selling a product with relatively low overhead, such as a book, right? Compared to something like a cell phone, or I don't know, like a tomahawk steak. I'm gonna take it one step further. Instead of actually having to sit down and write, right? Like come up with a new story or a new idea or a new topic to get into, hoping that it's gonna be good or hoping that the masses like what you have to say. He said, no, no, no. I'm gonna find a book that's already been written. And not only a book that's already been written, one of the most popular and beloved books of all time, the Bible. So he's already got a hit on his hands with that one. And then he figured, okay, well, how am I going to make this Bible different from other Bibles? So he found additional content from documents that are already just a part of the public domain. It also includes copies of the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, Pledge of Allegiance, Bill of Rights, and also some of the lyrics to the song, God Bless the USA. He only really had to get permission from the songwriter for God Bless the USA. His name is Lee Greenwood. However, I have a lot of questions, though, about what a presidential candidate is doing selling Bibles. I know that America was founded on the idea of separation of church and state. It just seems like such a bizarre move for a politician to be making right now. But I imagine that even just out of curiosity, there are probably a lot of people who are interested in getting their hands on a copy. But I guess we'll have to see how all of this shakes out. All right, Jay, thank you so much again for calling in with this question. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Barton Girdwood,
Alexis Williams,
Liam McBain,
Corey Antonio Rose.
This episode was edited by
Jessica Flacek.
Engineering support came from
Patrick Murray,
Neil T. Vault.
We have fact-checking help from
Greta Pittenger,
Barclay Walsh.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on Black experiences. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.